Hi, Michael.
Hello, Bob.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. Good to have you back. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You're Michael Young, the opinion page editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon, where you are right now, I believe.
That's right.
Although you've been traveling recently.
It doesn't count.
No. we talked not so long ago, a few weeks ago, I guess, and we got so wrapped up in talking about Syria that I failed to do one of the things I had set out to do, which is ask you a little more about Lebanon and the lay of the land there, the lay of the political land there. I do want to talk a little about Syria today. There have been developments there that are worth discussing. But I certainly want to get around to asking you some questions about Lebanon. I would like to lead into that maybe a little bit obliquely by touching on what has been a big story lately, here at least, which is Iran and evidence that Iran may indeed be working toward a nuclear weapon and discussion of a possible preemptive strike by Israel and so on. I wanted to ask you, from where you are in Lebanon, what seem to be the likely consequences of an Israeli strike, to the extent that you can guess?
Well, I think the biggest fear amongst the Lebanese is that if there is a strike, an Israeli strike against Iran, that Hezbollah, which is allied with Iran, would retaliate across the border. Mm-hmm. And that this would, of course, lead to a major conflagration between Lebanon and Israel. And this time the perception is that the Israeli response would be much more severe than 2006. The likelihood is that Israel would hit Lebanon's infrastructure, it would economic targets, that it would really be very, very devastating indeed, and coming at a time when Lebanon is facing economic difficulties, it would be, I think, 2006 would be relatively bearable in comparison. So that's, in a nutshell, is, I think, the biggest fear.
And does that seem plausible to you?
If there is a war, yes. And of course, I mean, I didn't mean to miss out, of course, on the humanitarian consequences of this. I think what would happen is, you would see hundreds of thousands of inhabitants of South Lebanon, most of them Shia, mm-hmm. swarming out of the south. Perhaps this time there would be the possibility of a more substantial ground war than the one we had in 2006. The humanitarian costs would be significant. Of course, the consequences in terms of you asked me about the likelihood of this. If there is a conflict, yes, I tend to see this type of scenario, something very severe indeed.
Okay, I guess embedded in that scenario is the question of Iran's exact relationship to Hezbollah. I've always assumed that Hezbollah must have some degree of autonomy. Clearly there is a kind of a subordinate relationship to Iran. Iran supplies Hezbollah with weapons and support, and Hezbollah owes Iran something in return, I guess, in its view. But I've always wondered to what extent it really is like a puppet master, you know, to what extent Iran really can get Hezbollah to do anything it wants, and to what extent it kind of has to persuade it to do things. And, of course, that's relevant to the question of what sort of retaliation Iran could muster against Israel in the event of a strike. Do you have a clear sense for what the relationship is between Iran and Hezbollah?
Look, I think it's a complex relationship. I think in certain things you're quite right. There is operational autonomy. Hezbollah does have a certain amount of operational autonomy. Hezbollah is obviously the link with the Shia community in Lebanon. I think the party has substantial latitude to deal with the community as it sees fit. I think there is trust in Hezbollah on the part of the Iranians. Hezbollah has been quite effective in in a sense, infiltrating, or if that word is seen as too alarmist, in fact, in expanding its influence over institutions in the Lebanese state. And I don't believe that it has done so necessarily with Iranian commissars looking over their shoulder. I don't think that's the case. On the other hand, I do think there is sometimes a tendency to overstate the autonomy when it comes to strategic issues. I think that on the strategic issues, Iran very much is in control of the party. And what do I mean by strategic issues? I think if Israel were to attack Iran and Iran were to ask Hezbollah to retaliate, I don't think Hezbollah would have a great deal of latitude to say no, even if this is not in the party's interests on the ground. I think in terms of the relationship with Syria, I don't think that Hezbollah had a great deal of latitude over all these years to challenge the, Iran's relationship with Syria, or indeed, you know, create problems for Iran's relationship with Syria. It depends on the issue. So it's a complex relationship. We shouldn't overstate the dependency, but I don't think we should understate it either when it comes to what Iran sees as vital strategic issues. Iran has not supplied Hezbollah with the sophisticated weaponry, including, it seems, missiles, as well as, it seems, anti-aircraft missiles and other types of sophisticated weaponry, simply to then allow the party to define its own interests independently of Iran. I mean, clearly, when it comes to conflict with Israel, with other forces, even the United States in Iraq, Hezbollah is there to act as an extension of Iran.
Okay, and the reason for Hezbollah's obedience is because it so much wants continuing support of the kind that Iran can provide?
Well, I think there are many issues. There is an ideological foundation there. Mm-hmm. Hezbollah does support the jurisconsult, in this case Ayatollah Khomeini. I mean, from the perspective of, you know, from that perspective, Hezbollah does see itself as its leader. Hassan Nasrallah has said many times as basically soldiers of the jurisconsult, in other words, the supreme Iranian leader. There is, of course, the fact that Hezbollah was essentially created by Iran. I think Iran continues to play a major role in funding the organization. These are not things that, you know, you don't have official reports on this, open reports. And even while Hezbollah does, I think, has secured other alternative sources of funding, it hasn't done so to increase its autonomy with respect to Iran. It has done so, in a sense, to secure, in a way, maybe to lessen the burden on Iran. But, you know, this is, Hezbollah is essentially, was established by Iran back in the 1980s. And I don't really see that at any point in the organizations, in the parties, history, there has been a substantial challenge to that basic foundational relationship between Iran and Hezbollah.
Okay, and so it's for that reason that you think if Israel attacked Iran, you would see a barrage of missiles from Lebanon into Israel, and that would provoke a counterattack at least as fierce as we saw in 2006.
Well, I believe that if Iran asks Hezbollah to retaliate, Hezbollah will retaliate. Now, if Iran determines that it's not in the interests of Hezbollah to retaliate, indeed that it would be better for Iran itself to retaliate directly, that may be, I mean, I don't think we should look at this mechanistically. Will there be automatically a Hezbollah retaliation? I think there will be a discussion of this. It may very well be, and there may very well be that relationship already built in, that understanding already built into the relationship, that any attack against Iran would be met with an automatic response. I don't know. But I think that, as I said, because it's not clear, we should perhaps keep a small door open and say, well, you know, the Iranians may decide not to retaliate immediately or directly through Hezbollah, I don't think that's the case. I think there will be a retaliation. But, you know, let's keep a little margin there of uncertainty.
Okay. Now, speaking of Hezbollah, as I said, I'd like to get a little into Lebanese politics, which I think most Americans don't know a lot about. I don't know much about. I mean, to judge by the structure of government, you know, you have this unusual system of government, and I think this is still intact, where specific offices are reserved for specific ethnic groups, right? And I think the four basic groups that are guaranteed representation in one high-ranking office or another are Sunni, Shia, Maronite Christian, which is a form of Catholicism, I think, and Greek Orthodox. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's everyone has some sort of role. Not everyone, but most of the major sects. I mean, essentially, yes, you're quite right. According to sort of the unwritten understandings reached by the Lebanese at independence, and even before then to a certain extent, the president is a Maronite Christian, the prime minister is a Sunni Muslim, the speaker of parliament is a Shia Muslim, the deputy prime minister is a Greek Orthodox, and then you get down into other posts that tend to be reserved for specific communities, religious communities. But by and large, yes, that's sort of what has been referred to as the Lebanese consociational system.
And I assume, judging by your last name, that by heritage you would belong to one of the two Christian groups. I mean, leaving aside the question of your actual beliefs, just in terms of heritage, that is the way you would be categorized by Lebanese as either Maronite or Greek Orthodox?
Well, actually, my name, my father was an American, so it's a good American name. It's not, but I am, because I am a Lebanese citizen, I am, yes, I'm categorized as a Roman Catholic. I'm categorized as a minority. In other words, there's one seat in parliament for minorities in the Beirut, in the capital. I don't vote in Beirut. I vote in a different district. Mm-hmm. But I'm from on my mother's side, I'm from a Maronite family. So, yes.
I see. And to what extent kind of is that predictive of your views? You know, I mean, in some countries, you can, just by knowing someone's ethnic background, predict with a fairly high confidence what their views on certain basic political issues will be, you know, and in some countries you can't. I guess I'm wondering to what extent you feel your views are shared by others who would be categorized as Catholic or Maronite. I mean, do you find that that your views are kind of typical? In other words, is it really is it very illuminating for us to know that you belong to this group, I guess is what I'm asking?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer. By and large, I think the question of someone's background is a relevant question in Lebanon. You can often know a lot about a person because of his background. I think we shouldn't overstate the sectarian aspect in forming people's ideas. Okay, there is regionalism in Lebanon. This is something that is often understated. You know, depending on which area a person comes from in the country, there is political tradition. You know, some families come from certain traditional political allegiances. You know, Lebanon is much more complex than just a question of what is your sectarian affiliation. At the same time, it's true, I think you can learn a lot from someone's sectarian affiliation, but it can also often lead you down blind alleys to assume that because so-and-so is a Shia or so-and-so is a Maronite, therefore they must think in this particular way. That's not the case. I think, like many, you know, societies, it depends what the context is, what context someone is discussing. I mean, let me just give you an example of the Maronite community. The Maronite community is traditionally a very pluralistic community. It's a very divided community politically. Even even at the time of the French Mandate, before independent Lebanon and then into independent Lebanon, you often had two broad alignments within the Maronite community, and they were in competition with each other. Mm-hmm. And in a way, this is a community which, you know, you may today take two Maronites and they may have a very similar perception of the community's future in the Middle East, in a Muslim-majority Middle East. And at the same time, they may be bitterly divided on Lebanese politics, you know, mm-hmm. some supporting one politician, some supporting a rival politician. In fact, one may come from one part of the country, another from another part of the country, and because they have different experiences within their specific part of the country, this may shape their political thinking. So, you know, it's I'm not giving a clear answer because there isn't one. I think it's always important to factor in a number of things, and then, you know, and then actually talk to people, because you'll find that there is always a certain amount of, you know, vigorous difference between different. The Shia community is another very good example. It's a very pluralistic, it's a complex community, and even if many tend to support Hezbollah, I think when you look more closely at how the community is structured, their beliefs on other issues, after all, not everything is Hezbollah when it comes to the Shia or to any other community, you will see invigorating differences. You know, there will be many spaces where politics will not enter, or where the political parties will not be able to enter and in a way dominate the thinking of people. So I think that's something that Lebanon it merits maybe a more complex approach to how the society is seen.
Okay, and the Shia are the largest of the groups I mentioned, and so are very consequential. I gather that the government was set up in such a way that did not initially give them power that is proportionate to their size, right? And that has been a long-standing kind of grievance of Shia. Is that right?
I think so, but I think it's become, this debate has become so complicated over the decades. It's quite true. Initially, the Shia community, which was not demographically what it is today. Incidentally, I mean, there is a debate even on demographics. Lebanon has not had a census since the late 1930s. Mm. So, you know, today we don't know if the Shia, I mean, it's quite possible that they're the largest single community, but it's not clear that they are much larger than the Sunni community, for example. What is clear is that the Christian numbers have gone down in relative terms. Mm-hmm. But over the decades, it's true that the Shia were underrepresented. Some would say they still are underrepresented, which is, you know, this is a case that has to be examined more closely. The Christians are certainly overrepresented. In other words, 50% of parliamentary seats are blocked for Christians, whereas they probably don't represent more than 30% of the population. Mm-hmm. But again, this is what is known as the Lebanese formula. Some people consider, I think quite recklessly, called this a form of apartheid. I think that this is a nonsensical description of what's going on. Part of the problem is that, you know, to change the Lebanese system, to make, you know, a majoritarian system or a proportional system, you will substantially have to redesign the political structure of the society, which will alarm the minorities, which may create quite a bit of an upheaval, and at the same time create problems between the two larger Muslim communities. I mean, this is something I believe that should be done. I think, in fact, this 50-50 split in parliament is something that should be reformed. Indeed, a constitutional reform project in the late 1980s, known as the Taif Agreement, has laid the groundwork for such a scheme. But the society is not able today to really move in that direction because of its divisions. But I don't think we should just focus on the Shia here. I think the Shia certainly are entitled to more more power when it comes to government offices. But the reality is that the Shiite today are probably the most influential community in Lebanon. Despite that, Hezbollah has considerable influence over the state, over the army, over the security services. The Shia community has put a lot of people in the bureaucracy, in the civil service. Mm-hmm. The Speaker of Parliament is an immensely powerful figure. He's much more powerful, to my mind, than the Maronite president, although technically he's inferior in rank. Mm-hmm. The Speaker of Parliament basically is in office for the duration of Parliament. He's not re-elected during Parliament. So he, in fact, Lebanon Speaker of Parliament has been in office since 1992. He's mm-hmm. the longest serving of the major figures that we discussed, the President, the Prime Minister, the Speaker of Parliament.
Okay.
So I think power is often not, we shouldn't be focused just on institutions. You know, the informal instruments of power often tell us much more about who really controls Lebanon. And I believe today the Shia community is probably the most powerful community when it comes to the state, mm-hmm. de facto, not de jure, but de facto. And it's a complex country.
And that is partly because of Hezbollah's influence?
Certainly because of Hezbollah's influence, the fact that the party still has arms, is armed, mm-hmm. has used these arms against other Lebanese groups, has the power of intimidation, and has also managed, I think, to control key segments or the commanding heights of the state. Mm-hmm. Even as economic actors today, over the last decade, two decades, the Shia community is a very dynamic community. It's a community that has a very vigorous diaspora. In the past we always had this notion of the Shia community as the poorest of the Lebanese communities, but the reality is that I don't think that's true today. If you go to South Lebanon, for example, you can see that there is a great deal of money, of investment. People have built homes, have come back emigrants have come back, have built homes in the south. There is money there. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to minimize the poverty in the Shia community, but there is also great poverty in the Sunni community.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, on what issues is it safest to assume that Hezbollah does speak for a large majority of the Shia? On what issues do they most have the allegiance of the Shia? And on what issues is that less the case?
Look, I think Hezbollah does speak for a majority of Shia, but it does speak for for a number of reasons. Obviously, the party is perceived as, and I think to a certain extent correctly, as having liberated South Lebanon mm-hmm. from the Israelis. But I think more profoundly, the party has in a way affirmed Shia power and rights in Lebanon. So in a sense, the community sees Hezbollah as essential to having, in a sense, promoted the community and the importance of the community in Lebanese society. Now, the reverse side of this, I think, is that many Shia would say today that if Hezbollah were to lose power forcibly, then the Shia community as a whole would lose power.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, this, I believe many people have, I say unfortunately, this has had a very stifling influence on the community. Because I don't believe, first mm-hmm. of all, that it's true. I think that Hezbollah, in many respects, has been, while it has certainly been instrumental in affirming Shia power in Lebanon, it has also, to a certain extent, isolated the Shia in Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
Isolated them within the context of this traditional social contract, the Lebanese social contract. It's not a good thing, I think, today that the Shia are perceived by the many other Lebanese as, in a way, in a category of their own. They're allowed to have weapons. They have their own geographical areas in which the state cannot enter or enters with difficulty, let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
even paradoxically, as the party and its other Shia allies have inserted their people into the state. You know, they've used the state like everybody else as a source of patronage.
But seems to me
I don't think, though, in the long run, this is in the interest of the Shia community. I think ultimately the Shia will only truly begin to prosper and begin, in a way, to prosper. It will in a way, reach their full potential when they are able to transcend what, for me, is an authoritarian, centralized, militarized, religious party. This is a community that can go beyond that.
But at the same time, it seems to me that, at least in the abstract, this is an argument for moving toward a system of truly proportional representation. Because, I mean, I assume that the reason the Shia think that their influence depends on the continued power of Hezbollah is because, at a certain level, it does, right? The fact that they are kind of represented by this party that is in some ways an independent militia, that does give them a kind of power that that presumably, in their view, partly compensates for the fact that the Constitution doesn't, whatever the system of government, does not give them that much power, right? I mean, isn't it at least conceivable that, well, go ahead.
Well, no, but I mean, that's a good point. I think you're quite right. Let me immediately run to the conclusion, the implicit conclusion from what you've said. If today you were to offer to the Shia community greater power in the Lebanese state, would Hezbollah welcome that, or would it be very uncomfortable with that? I think it would be very uncomfortable with that, because it would understand that such dynamics, that these dynamics implicitly would impose on the party some form of disarmament. In other words, if you're integrating the Shia community more into the state, giving them more power, then somehow the quid pro quo, the exchange for that, would be that they would no longer need this militia. To a certain extent, I agree with that logic. I think Hezbollah has, in a way, it's been behaved very paradoxically towards the Lebanese system. It has condemned the sectarian system, historically, and on the grounds that it's an unfair system, and so on and so forth, and that it, Hezbollah, is in a way a revolutionary force. At the same time, it's exploited the sectarian system by saying, we are the best party able to defend Shia rights in the system. So I think your question is a good one, a very useful one. I think also, the reality is, though, that, yes, the system does need reform. It does need reform. There is, as I said, a blueprint or an outline for reform in what is known as the Ta'if Agreement. But for there to be reform on getting rid of the sectarian system, or let me say this, transcending the sectarian system, what you need is a national dialogue. And the fact of the matter is that today there are many obstacles to this. First of all, the Christians are very fearful of giving up their rights, because they feel that they've already lost enough power. If they lose more, they will be, this will pose an existential threat to them. There's another issue that I think is equally important, if not more important. It's that the Sunni community will not sit down at the table with the Shia community if Hezbollah has its weapons. They will not sit down at the table and bargain with a community that is armed, that they perceived as being armed, and is armed, and when they themselves are not armed, you see. So this has blocked any kind of a dialogue on the reforming the Lebanese political or sectarian system, on transcending it, in a way, on getting rid of these sectarian, quotas that we were talking about earlier.
Okay. Let me ask you one final question about the kind of role of ethnicity in politics. It's actually just a specific question related to that. is it the case that your newspaper, the Daily Star, has an essentially Christian readership? In other words, there is fragmentation in media. I mean, A, that it has an essentially Christian readership, and B, that's generally the way media work there?
No, I don't think we should make that mistake. No, the Daily Star, I don't know, I don't have a breakdown of its readership, but I don't believe it's an essentially Christian readership at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Star, you know, it has a lot of foreign readers, but among the Lebanese, I think you have to look at who reads and speaks English in Lebanese society.
Okay.
An increasing number of young people do, because it's the language of, if you want, of international business relations, so forth. Now, expanding to the Arabic press, once again, I mean, it's true that there are different newspapers that will appeal to certain communities. Let me give you an example. The Al-Mustaqbal, which is owned by Saad Al-Hariri. Incidentally, I mean, full disclosure, the Daily Star is owned majority by Saad Hariri today.
Hmm.
And I throw in that I've never personally had any pressure put on me to, in one way or another, by the Hariri people, until now. But that doesn't mean that the people who read the Star are Hariri people. If you look at Al-Mustaqbal, which is much more of a party paper, yes, by and large, you will probably see that its readership tends to be Sunni, supporters of the future movement. Take another newspaper, I just throw out one. Al-Anwar is traditionally read by a Christian readership. It's a small newspaper, an old newspaper in Lebanon, probably has a Christian readership. But again, that's not political. That's because traditionally the paper is appealed to that kind of readership. But there are other newspapers that are cross-sectarian. I think An-Nahar, which is probably the most famous Lebanese newspaper, appeals to a big variety of readers in terms of their sectarian makeup. And we can go on. I mean, okay. News, as I said, we shouldn't focus on sect in everything when analyzing Lebanon. It's important, but there are other factors. To give you an example, a newspaper like As-Safir is traditionally a leftist newspaper, supportive of the Palestinians in the 1970s. It still has, there are still leftist Christians who read Al-Safir, people belonging to the old left who read As-Safir. I mean, I'm simplifying a lot of this, but sure. I don't think we should just assume there are Christian papers and Sunni papers and Shia papers and so on. It's really more complicated than that.
Now, we have a few minutes left. I did want to touch on the subject that dominated our last conversation, Syria, because last time we spoke, you were asking for the world to do more in the way of hastening the demise of the regime in Syria. I mean, you weren't calling for outside Western military intervention or anything, but you were asking for more pressure. And just within this last week, some interesting developments, namely the Arab League suspended Syria. And also, I think yesterday the King of Jordan called on the President of Syria to step down, if I'm recalling this correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
are you happy with the way things are moving? I mean, do you attach significance to these things?
Well, yes, these are very significant developments. Am I happy? In the end, what can anyone wish for in Syria above all else? It's a peaceful transition of power. In other words, a transition of power without Syria falling into a full-fledged civil war. I think, and I'm not sure if we discussed this last time, but I mean, I've long thought for months that the regime was finished. I have trouble seeing how Bashar al-Assad can take Syria back to where it was in January of this year. I don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, today, what we see is almost an affirmation of this on the part of the Arab countries. King Abdullah's statement was quite significant. As you said, he basically advised Bashar al-Assad step down. The Arab states are worried that if Syria were to collapse into a civil war, that this would, of course, suck in other countries in the region. It would have an impact in Lebanon, it would have an impact in Iraq. This is very worrisome to the Arab states. I think, again, my skepticism from last time, I think the Arabs gave Bashar enough time to crush the rebellion. Mm-hmm. When they saw that he couldn't do that, then they reacted. You know, I don't think that they behaved in any way morally or you know, they gave him basically a long time to repress. But they realize today that this is turning into a conflict, an armed conflict. So, am I happy? I'm happy, yes, with a lot of qualifications, in the sense that what do you do now? How do you ensure that a smooth transition? And that's a question I wish I had a simple answer to.
But you're saying that apparently it is the Arab League's judgment that at this point the most likely path to stability is for him to step down, whereas they previously thought you could have a stable outcome with him in the saddle. Their judgment is that that's no longer the case.
I think they gave him room, latitude to crush the rebellion. He couldn't do it. Now they realize that the policies of the Syrian regime, which mm-hmm. are essentially sectarian policies, mm-hmm. what we see in Syria today is basically an Alawi minority in alliance with other minorities, but primarily the Alawi elite in the military, in the security services, trying to essentially to save the system that they mm-hmm. dominated. The Arabs were, I think, willing to allow that to a certain extent, mm-hmm. if it meant stability. But they realized that today we're very much going into the opposite direction, towards greater instability that is sectarian, mm-hmm. because we're heading into a Alawi-Sunni conflict. We've seen the first elements of that. Mm-hmm. And so I think they want to avert a civil war. And, now we have to see what pressure they can bring to bear and how the Syrian regime reacts. Now, any transition, let me add, you know, has to take into consideration the Alawis. In other words, to get rid of the Alawis and allow a massacre of Alawis is not the solution either to the problem. Mm-hmm. We've seen in Libya the problem there, that's more of a tribal issue there, but we've noticed that the transition has not been a smooth one away from Gaddafi. Right. I think the Arab states want to avoid a situation similar to that in Syria. Mm-hmm. So how you can sort of get rid of the Assads who are refusing to leave, and at the same time integrate the Alawis into a transition is mm-hmm. really a very complex question.
Mm-hmm. Do the Shia in Lebanon and maybe elsewhere identify very intensely with the Alawites, or are the Alawites considered a sufficiently eccentric sect or whatever within the Shia tradition that there isn't so much of an ethnic bond there?
Well, I think if we're talking at the communal level, individuals, if you go to the Shia take a Shia in the southern suburbs of Beirut or the south, and you ask him, what is your view of the Alawites? Mm-hmm. They would probably not really have much of an answer. They don't deal with a lot of Alawis. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, politically speaking, Hezbollah and its supporters mm-hmm. do understand that if the Alawis in Syria lose, this will have negative repercussions for Hezbollah, and therefore, by extension, perhaps for the Shia community in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. In other words, this would be seen by the Sunnis as a victory. Mm-hmm. It would, in a sense, embolden Lebanon Sunnis at the expense, they see, again, this is perceptions we're talking about, this would mm-hmm. embolden Lebanon Sunnis at the expense of the Shia, and so forth. Mm-hmm. This is a political call, rather than, if you want, an emotional bond with the Alawi community. It's true that, you know, during the 1970s, if I recall, Imam Musa Sadr, who was then seen as the spiritual head of the Lebanese Shia community at the time, a leading figure, had sort of declared that the Alawi community was Shia, you know, lending legitimacy on the community. But by and large, I think, you know, the Shia in Lebanon tend to look at this more in a refracted way, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of minority politics. And even, you know, a portion of the Christian community in Lebanon sees the same way. They say, well, you know, if the Sunnis gain in Syria, this will have repercussions on us, on our interests in Lebanon. Not all Christians, by the way. Mm-hmm. Again, the Christians are always divided. A portion of the Christians is with the rebellion in Syria. Others are with the regime. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's the short answer. Politically, those who support Hezbollah tend to support the Assad regime. Mm-hmm. But if I could just throw in, I think Hezbollah, they're not stupid. I think the party has already come to the conclusion that this regime will not survive in the long term. And I think that they are thinking of a plan B. What is the plan B? I don't know. But I think they are prepared.
And by that, do you mean that no Alawite regime survives? I mean that the days of Alawite dominance in Syria are over? Have they reached that conclusion?
I think they have. I think they've reached the conclusion that this regime is not going to survive in the long term. Now, again, we're in a very fluid and complex situation. So who defines any future transition? It's unclear. Mm-hmm. But I think Hezbollah... they know well what's going on. They understand the dynamics. I don't think they've put all their eggs. In fact, I doubt that they've put all their eggs in the Assad basket.
Yeah, but Syria is considered an important link in the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran. Although I have to admit that when I finally looked at a map today, I realized I don't totally understand why. Because you always hear that Syria, you know, kind of conveys Iranian weapons or Iranian financed weapons to Lebanon. But I realized today that Syria actually is not adjacent to Iran. So we're talking about the actual transport of weapons from Iran, they would have to go through Turkey or Iraq to get to Syria in the first place. So are we actually talking about weapons financed by Iran but made in Syria, or is the conveyor belt more circuitous than I had imagined, or what?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, I'm not an expert on these issues. So, I mean, look, I think let's be clear. Yes, I mean, certainly things can go through Iraq. Perhaps that's happened. The Iranians have sufficient influence in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Yes, things can go through Damascus and via Damascus to Lebanon. And let's be honest, I mean, the Iranians can send certain types of weapons via Beirut Airport. I mean, Hezbollah controls Beirut Airport. I don't think we should have any illusions about this. I think the real question, Bob, is strategic depth. It's that today, if there is a war between, let's say, Israel and Hezbollah, and Syria is hostile to Hezbollah, let's imagine a new Syrian regime hostile to Hezbollah. This all but negates Hezbollah's ability to conduct a war. Mm-hmm. Already, there are deep problems the party has within Lebanese society on a future war. Okay, because clearly more than half of the society would be opposed, for example, to Hezbollah taking Lebanon into a war against Israel on behalf of Iran. So that as the party is fighting, it would have to its rear a very angry Sunni community, I think a substantial number of Christians who are very angry, even its political allies in the Christian community would be very, very reluctant to engage in a war on behalf of Iran. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about fighting. If you're fighting, you don't want to have in your back a substantial number of people who are hostile to you. Mm-hmm. Now, add to that, in the midst of a conflict, a Syrian government, which potentially would be again, hostile to Iran, to Hezbollah and to Iran. Hezbollah effectively would not be able, to conduct a war in that context. Mm-hmm. It would effectively negate the party. Mm-hmm. Now, I also believe that Hezbollah, while it's aware of this, is probably thinking in terms of maintaining its margin of maneuverability in such a context. In other words, I think it still is thinking in terms of how can we control the commanding heights of the Lebanese state to ensure, to protect ourselves, and to ensure in the event of a war that we will not be threatened in our rear. Mm-hmm. I think this is a personally, I think this is, in a way, this is on their part a calculation, a mistaken calculation. But I still believe they feel that they can continue to dominate Lebanese society, to keep a hold on Lebanese society, and fight a war. But this is the real issue. It's the strategic depth that Syria gives the party. Syria can intimidate Hezbollah's foes in Lebanon. Syria mm-hmm. can keep the arms pipeline open in the event of a war. Mm-hmm. So you're quite right to say that if the Syrian regime falls, this will have a significant impact on Iran's interest in the eastern Mediterranean and on Hezbollah.
Yeah, well, this is interesting. I hadn't really appreciated the interconnection between Syria's fate and the likely result of an Israeli strike in Iran, but the two are connected. In other words, Iran's menu of options in how to retaliate could be influenced by a change of government in Syria, and I hadn't really thought of that.
Sure, and let me just throw in one thought. I mean, you know, Israel looks at this, and Israel, too, sees this situation. So does this make Israel more likely to strike against Iran or mm-hmm. to strike against Hezbollah in the near future? Something to consider.
Do they wait for a hoped-for change of government in Syria, which Israel wasn't necessarily enthusiastic about in the beginning because they do fear instability, but
yes,
you can
right.
imagine them now thinking, well, if we sit this out, then Iran's ability to respond to a strike may be complicated by a change of regime in Syria.
On the other hand, yes, but if we look today, I think there is also a contrary view, because we're talking about scenarios, is that if today there is a war between Israel and Iran, which brings in Hezbollah in Syria, mm-hmm. in a way this may be precisely what the Syrian regime needs to save its
sure.
skin, you
sure.
see. So... Again, it's, you know, it's like a game of three-dimensional chess. If you move somewhere, it may have an impact on a different dimension or on a different plane elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's who knows.
Yeah, kind of makes me happy. I live where I live instead of where you live, Michael. I have to admit, but you sound reasonably happy.
Well, I'm very anxious, but I think, as I said, I think there is a lot, at least from the Lebanese perspective, there is mm-hmm. a lot that is very worrisome taking place around us.
So you are not calling on Israel to launch a strike today or tomorrow, it sounds like.
No, certainly not. I don't think that a strike, if you're talking about a strike against Iran, mm-hmm. I think this would be a disaster. I don't think it would work. You know, we can go at the, you know, look at the several levels of consequences, and there will be very negative consequences at several levels. No, I'm not supportive of such, and not only because of Lebanon, please. It's not just a parochial calculation. I think it would actually strengthen the Iranians to an extent. I think it would strengthen the Syrian regime,
mm-hmm.
and not to mention what it would do to the world economy. But that's yeah. another issue.
Okay. Well, this has been very illuminating. There's a lot of stuff that emerged that I hadn't thought about. So thank you for taking the time. And I hope you have less to be anxious about in the future. And in any event, maybe we'll check back in with you down the road and see.
Very good. I'm
okay.
here.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Michael.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care.